It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us once again. Good morning, folks.
Good morning, Ben. Morning,
all
Ben.
Right, what are we talking about today?
Ben, last week we spoke about homeowners associations,
mm-hmm.
And of course, just the structure that exists between, you know, a planned subdivision, if you will, a development.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, most times these developments have a declaration that they will, in fact, have a nonprofit corporation,
mm-hmm.
such as a homeowners association, govern the use, if you will, and the enjoyment of the subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the homeowners association, then the nonprofit corporation would have bylaws.
Right.
And it would have a roadmap that the association is to follow. And additionally, the developer more than likely put on the property, if you will, certain restrictions, covenants,
mm-hmm.
declaration of restrictive covenants as to how the property is to be used. And so the dynamic exists now for there many times to be confusion as to how the covenants interplay with the bylaws,
mm-hmm.
Things of that nature. We get a lot of questions in that area.
Right.
So that's kind of what we're spending last week and this week kind of deciphering and explaining to our listeners.
And Wes, these homeowners associations are quasi-governmental units. I mean, they really have a lot
yes.
of power in them.
Well, yeah, no question about that. And, you know, it's an interesting dynamic because you've got usually people that don't have much in the way of background as it relates to managing
mm-hmm.
real property or dealing with these, you know, somewhat legal issues,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even managing people. But these are just, in many cases, retirees, sometimes, you know, just owners in the subdivision with all kinds of different backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
but they end up making up the board of directors.
Right.
And they end up being the ones who are the decision makers. So, you know, sometimes, you know, we see it kind of set up as there potentially being problems right from the beginning because, you know, you've got people managing people and property with maybe not a whole lot of experience with that, maybe learning as they go to a certain extent.
Exactly. So again, and they change, you know, that with other elections, you can have a
turnover. That's right. So. Yep. You've got turnover with regard to the board and the different committees, so
mm-hmm.
on and so forth. And, you know, one committee might see it differently than another, you know, particular issues in the subdivision. Sometimes there's not a smooth transition with regard to, you know, maybe they're being staggered terms.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got, you know, people who stagger from one term to the next, obviously, so
mm-hmm.
that the new members know how it was kind of done by the old board members, so that, you know, we don't have just a dramatic change in the way things are done, which is sometimes shocking to people.
Yeah. Are there variances in how these nonprofit corporations are set up? I mean, are they all set up with the same kind of rules or?
Generally, mm-hmm. they're set up under North Carolina General Statute 55A.
Mm-hmm.
And then the variation really comes in the bylaws themselves,
mm-hmm.
Or the covenants, declarations of covenants themselves. That typically is where the variation is. I mean, sometimes we see subdivisions that
mm-hmm.
are different because maybe they don't own their road. Maybe it's a city road, but they are subject to covenants.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they do own their road and they own, you know, other common areas, and that kind of ties everyone together.
Right.
So yeah, they're different. Every case is different and every subdivision is, you know, has little twists and turns within it. But from a property owner's perspective, you know, we're kind of talking about the issue of the fact that you own this land.
Mm-hmm.
This is your property. This is your home. We start at a point where you can do what you want to on your property.
Right.
Except for the fact that now you're in a subdivision and there's some uniformity that has to be brought forward so that, you know, the common scheme that was originally intended by the developer is carried through.
Mm-hmm.
We want it to look nice. We want it to look generally the same, not cookie cutter so much, but you know, folks need to understand that just because it's your property doesn't mean you can do anything you want to on the property.
Well, some communities are set up for a sort of a personality. Like you might have one that's a boating community. It might have a build around a golf course.
Right.
So they can have different personalities. I mean, the one that's going to have docks may have different rules than the one that has cart paths.
That's exactly right.
And we have always said, Ben, to go back a little bit historically, we've always encouraged, and now I encourage our listeners, you know, these are very important inquiries to make during your, if you will, when you're looking for that perfect place to retire, when you're looking to size down, if you will, and live in a smaller, you know, environment, which I hear a lot about,
right,
you know, with retired clients.
Sure.
It's very important that you look at the restrictive covenants and understand them. Make inquiries as to pending litigation with the association and the homeowners. I mean, you don't want to buy into a property that is, you know, within the next 3 years going to have a $10,000 assessment to every homeowner to fight the litigation over the conflict that's going on over at the golf course within the community,
right,
or
right,
the clubhouse within the community, or the docks within the community. You know, this is all good, good. You cannot ask enough questions about this. You are buying into a democracy. You are only one vote. And so, you know, better safe than sorry. Ask all these questions. Our realtor friends are wonderful, but let's face it, they want to make a sale.
Sure.
You know, walking up and down the street, knocking on a few doors, doing your own self-inquiry, is, I think, absolutely critical if you're going to buy into one of these, which everyone does now. There's, it's very unusual to just have a piece of property that really kind of isn't within a development, if you will. Now, keep in mind, everything we're talking about applies to your second home condominium.
Right.
The
right.
same issues are all out there when you buy in any of our popular condominium communities. The next thing you know, you buy, you know, on the third floor, and here comes the assessment, you know, for the problems that are happening on the 12th floor. But yet everyone within the building is being assessed because of certain issues that are happening. So, you know, if you know about them, great.
Right.
But if you don't know about them, then it can be a problem.
Okay. All right. And again, these are issues that that crop up, and that's taking part in that governance. I mean, they do have meetings, board meetings. You can go to them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can take part in it. But, you know, kind of where the rubber hits the road, you know, from my perspective, when I see issues is that, you know, when individual property owners, you know, kind of go on their own way with regard to what they think they can do. You know, in general, you know, when you move into a homeowners association, a subdivision, you can look around and kind of see what's accepted and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, you can see that. You can see what kind of fences are put up, what kind of mailboxes there are, what size houses there are, how high the houses are, what's the elevation, what kind of materials are used, colors, whether their trailers parked in the driveway. I mean, these are all the kind of things that, you know, typically covenants may address. So you get a general idea about that. But where, from a property owner's perspective, as I said, the rubber hits the road is where maybe someone decides, well, I'm going to go ahead and put a fence here because I want a fence here.
Right.
Well, I've got a dog and my dog needs to stay in, and somebody's complaining about the dog. I'm going to put the fence in. Or I'm going to paint my house a certain color and don't really ask and just do it. Or I'm going to, you know, keep my trailer in my driveway for as long as I want to and just see what happens, that kind of thing. Well, and then, you know, obviously, if any of those things end up being in breach of the covenants or potentially of the rules and regulations, then we get into an issue where letters get sent and maybe people get their defenses up a little bit. And then sometimes we get involved, you know, with that. And the question oftentimes from property owners and from the actual homeowners associations, and we represent both sides, and mm-hmm. we have over the years in many different subdivisions, would be, you know, what can we do about the fact that we've got this going on this particular piece of property? And, you know, and maybe that's the board asking that question. I've got three people complaining about it. Feel mm-hmm. like we need to do something about it, Collins. What do we do?
Right.
And the property owner on the other hand is saying, well, I mean, look down the road. My fence looks just like his fence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So you get into that dynamic sometimes.
And, yeah. and this goes back to that part where people change on committees as well.
Right.
You know, some may be more enforcement conscious than others, and it doesn't mean the rules change.
That's a great point, because most covenants have language in them that indicates that just because there's been certain things allowed in a subdivision,
mm-hmm.
that does not serve as a waiver with mm-hmm. regard to any subsequent improvements
right.
in the subdivision that may be consistent therewith. So
okay.
you're not off the hook just because your fence looks like the guys down the street.
If you have questions, 800-818-2255 are these local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
As we continue with Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, in just a moment. Hey, welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. Thanks for joining us here. And as always, on Tuesday mornings, you can ask your legal questions with our experts from Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, Cecil and Wes with us once again, talking about homeowners associations.
Yeah, so we're talking about a situation where there may be a breach of the covenants mm-hmm. and, you know, what happens at that point in time. And, you know, if the mailbox doesn't fit within what the association says it should mm-hmm. look like, or the fence is in the wrong place, the wrong height, or you can't even have a fence. Can the board of directors, you know, just go out and have that removed
mm-hmm.
and then charge the homeowner?
Right.
No, they don't have the right to do that. They don't have the right to go on the particular individual's property and fix whatever the problem is. And the way that our General Assembly has addressed that is under the Planned Community Act.
Mm-hmm.
It's been in place, I'd say, around 20 years now, which in, you know, the world of the law, that's pretty young, actually.
Yeah,
and there's
right.
been a lot of development through cases up at the North Carolina Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of North Carolina dealing with interpretation of the Planned Community Act. And we've handled a number of cases up through the Court of Appeals on these issues. So we deal with this quite often. But generally speaking, when you're talking about a breach of the covenants and an ongoing breach, and
mm-hmm.
Maybe the property owner and the association board of directors has come to loggerheads on this and they just can't come to a resolution, then the remedy for the association is to give notice to the property owner
right.
what the particular breach is and give them an opportunity to correct the breach. And in the event they don't do that, then put them on notice of their right to a hearing
mm-hmm.
where they have a right to come forward and put on evidence as to why they say that they're not in breach of the covenants. And in the event that they don't prevail with regard to that within 5 days or after 5 days after
mm-hmm.
the determination that they are in breach, then the association has the right to impose a fine, a daily fine of up to $100 per day
mm-hmm.
until this is corrected. So you can't go on the property and take down the fence,
right?
But you can impose $100 a day fine until the fence is taken down, that type of situation.
And that's because it's a breach of the covenant.
Right.
Not a bylaw.
That's
problem.
Right. That's right.
So this is where it gets confusing sometimes. And also, who can offer that notification? Because I have experience, and I'm sure you do, with folks who maybe it's a committee chair or something who is notifying somebody, but
right.
they haven't had a vote by the committee or a vote by a board or anything.
Right. Well, the Planned Community Act addresses that in two different ways. It indicates that the board may have an adjudicatory panel,
mm-hmm.
which is like their little.
Sure.
Bunch of judges
right.
make
right.
a decision.
Not unusual.
Or an architectural control committee who
mm-hmm.
can, you know, let them know. Or the board of directors. I mean, the two that could hear the matter would be mm-hmm. the adjudicatory panel or the board of directors. And in the event it's an adjudicatory panel, you have a right to appeal to the board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
In the event it's the board of directors, you have to appeal, you know, basically to court.
To the court.
Yeah, yeah. That's the process for doing that. But, you know, when we're talking about $100 a day, you mm-hmm. know, $3,000 a month, my goodness, a lot of times the fences start to come down.
Right.
You know, when we're talking about that situation, because not only can the association impose that kind of fine, they have the right to enforce it as a lien against the property mm-hmm. and foreclose on the property in order to enforce that lien. Now, my goodness, we really try to avoid that
yeah.
in every situation. We don't want that to ever, you know, get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
We've had a couple cases that maybe I could talk about at some point in time mm-hmm. that are over now, but have gone for years over relatively small issues on people's property where they felt as though they had the right to do something on the property and the association didn't, and they just right. fight it to the end.
Now, you have sometimes in larger developments, you'll have sub-developments, I mean smaller units, right, that
right.
each have their own association.
That's right.
Correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, Brandywine yeah.
Brandywine
is one of those.
One. Yeah.
They have a master, yeah,
mm-hmm.
have a master association,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the way, and then they have multiple smaller subdivisions within the
larger. There's different types of housing. You have the patio
right.
homes that have
exactly
one.
Little PUDs within mm-hmm. the subdivision, and you know. But the way that generally works is that you have a master set of covenants
mm-hmm.
that encompasses all of the property, generally that's described in those covenants, which mm-hmm. usually would cover the entire subdivision. For example, like Brandywine,
right?
But then you have subsets of covenants for the particular area, like, you know, a Hammocks Place or
right.
smaller areas.
Brandywine's in Carteret County, and everybody listening probably has one right down the road from
that's
them.
That's right.
Very
just giving a description of this kind of mm-hmm. sub-association within the master association.
Okay, more to come in a moment here. If you have questions, 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. Mandy's standing by to take your call, and we'll have more on Let's Talk Legal. Hey, welcome back to the program. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. We've been talking about Homeowners Association, but let's see what Archie from Jacksonville has for us today. Hi, Archie. How are you?
Fine.
All right. What's your question?
What is the disposition of the monies that are assessed from people on fines?
So what happens to the fines?
Generally, it goes into the general fund. I mean, this association money.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like it's normally taken into the account with regard to just dues that are accepted. There's nothing in the statute that indicates that the fines that are imposed have to be used for any particular purpose. So it becomes association money.
It's just used for their landscaping or whatever else they do.
Whatever is in their budget. They can put it wherever they want to.
So they have guidelines, too.
Who is that? The association?
The association.
Well, typically, you know, they would look at, you know, their procedures with regard to how they normally deal with these monies. But in most associations, they're not going to really have much in the way of rules with regard to what we're going to do with fine money. They probably would.
They just throw it in the bank and it becomes part of whatever else
they
spend.
It becomes their general operating fund for roads or, mm-hmm. you know, paying the electric bill or whatever it might be.
And you should see it reflected in a budget.
Oh yeah, it would go on the financial statement. Mm-hmm. So it's just association.
So the association is required to publish a financial statement.
As a property owner, you have the right under North Carolina General Statute 55A, if you're a property owner in the subdivision, to make a request for all financial records of the association, and they have to produce those. There's a particular provision in the statute. I think it's 55A-. I was at the end of 55A. I don't want to say it because I don't have the book right here in front of me. But nevertheless, you have the right to get that information. And yes, most associations, you know, they should have financial records, a financial statement indicating, you know, a balance sheet, you know, their assets and, you know, just your standard financial statement.
Okay. Thank you.
The reason I'm asking this, the subdivision I moved into in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
I was told by the realtor, well, yes, there was an association, but it had dissolved.
Right.
So we just don't have a leg to stand on then.
Right. Well, it may not be technically a homeowners association. It may be a subdivision now with covenants that are still of record, but any individual property owner has the right to enforce covenants. You do not have to have an actual board of directors.
So you got to find the covenants.
You got to find the covenants. And in the event that you find that someone is in breach of those, then you would have the right to enforce those. Now, you might have to go to court to do that, but.
Thank you, Archie. Keep listening because we got a Facebook question that kind of relates to this, too. It says, what happens if there's no active HOA established, but there were covenants for the subdivision?
There we go. I think I just answered that question.
Yeah, that's the same thing.
Right. So the law allows individual owners within the subdivision who would have standing. I mean, they have an interest in mm-hmm. this. They want to keep their subdivision
but now you have to get
consistent with the covenants. And you probably, you know, you can ask the property owner to correct whatever the behavior is. But then in order to require it, then you most likely would have to deal with that through court.
And you don't have to have other property owners join you in that.
No.
No.
You do not.
Okay. See, and again, I think that's a lot of them. As you mentioned, 1975, we have a lot of neighborhoods around here that are older than that. So,
right.
So there are obviously there may be some where there have been inactive boards and they've just gone away.
The other thing you get, there's a lot of things.
Can you reactivate them?
Yeah, you can get organized, sure, if you have enough interest,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, you know, another thing among many things that you deal with when you have an older subdivision that maybe has covenants that's not active
mm-hmm.
is statute of limitations issues.
Right.
I mean, if they're, let's say we've been talking about fences, so let's say everyone's got a fence now, but the covenants say no fences, and one individual says, I don't want you to have fences. So they try to enforce it. Well, there probably is a 6-year, depending on the circumstances, a 6-year statute of limitations with regard to those fences under
mm-hmm.
what's called an incorporeal hereditament. Don't ask me to spell that right now in the morning. But nevertheless, that is typically your statute of limitations for
mm-hmm.
improvements on real property that would otherwise be affected or restricted by the covenants.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the stuff that may have gone on over the years, maybe too late to do anything about it anyway.
Right.
So,
right. Can a subdivision that has inactive, can you reorganize into a smaller group? I mean, that takes in only certain properties instead of the entire place?
The devil is going to be in the details.
Uh-huh.
We've got to look at the documents. We've got to look at the covenants.
How it was originally set up.
We've got to look at how we were originally set up. But in most cases, you probably could. But the issue is how much interest are you really going to have to do that?
252-726-9050, 726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street. That's where you'll find HarvellandCollins.com.